For great-looking t-shirts, hoodies, and sweatshirts, the TNT Shop is now open at tntradio.live. This is the Alan Miller Show on today's News Talk, TNT Radio.
Welcome, welcome from around the world. Hello, everyone in the United Kingdom. Great to be here today. What a week we've had. And hello, everyone in America, if you're just waking up, and in Australia. It's later in the evening there, Asia and internationally. Well, it's been a monumental week again. We've seen all sorts of things happen in the press. And, you know, major, major discussions. We've won some great victories. In the last little period, we've seen Mark Harper, the Department of Transport Secretary, saying that they no longer will be funding livable streets, active travel, the road closures, the low traffic neighbourhoods, because it's damaging to businesses, communities and residents. Hooray! That's a great victory for everyone who campaigned and lobbied. Mark Harper and others. Now it remains to be seen to get the local authorities to back away, because they're making a lot of money from these Checkpoint Charlie road closures, these surveillance AMPR cameraed tools that do nothing to benefit us and are hugely detrimental. So that's a great victory. We also have seen that over 50,000 people responded to the consultation around cash and central bank digital currency, which is great. And they were truly shocked at the Treasury, Andrew Griffith and others. And they've heard our voice loud and clear. And we're going to keep campaigning around that. And of course, still the ongoing issue of banks being closed and a pushback and a fight back against that. And we're all making our voice heard together. It's great that that's all hitting the news, as are many other things. And you know, one of the things that's central to Together Declaration, the Together Association, and this show that I do, and many of us at TNT and many of you out there, is freedom of speech and freedom of conscience and freedom of association. And this week as well in the news has been a new report that's come out by Don't Divide Us, a very important report that's looking at how councils and the Department for Education has adopted, in many instances, a strategy around presenting Britain as though it's institutionally racist, from the whole historic context to the contemporary one. Also, many articles have appeared in the press and the Times and many others, with Dr. Tony Sewell commenting on that. And we're going to be talking very soon to Dr. Alka Selga Cuthbert, who is one of the founders of Don't Divide Us, a campaigner around this issue, a teacher, and it's going to be very good to be talking to her. We've also got in the show Bev Jackson later on, who will be talking about the LGB Alliance and the recent court case where there was an attempt to shut their charitable status down and all the backdrop to the discussion about that. And what a lot of it all comes down to currently is this impulse to suffocate, to shut down, and to regulate and close, and not to have an open debate, not to discuss and thrash these things out civilly and to try and win hearts and minds, but much more about cancelling people, about saying, you know, they're going to go for legal routes or to kind of cancel them from their positions. And we've seen a really healthy fight back in the last couple of years with lots of different organisations that have been courageous and brave, that have challenged that, stood up to it. And that together, we certainly are championing free speech. That's why we think that we want to, as many people as possible, should challenge the online safety bill with our campaign around that, because it's essential that we get to debate and thrash out these issues in public. Now, one of the, we were also going to be talking to Lois Perry, but last week we had the whole problem because I was on the coast and there was an issue with Wi-Fi. It's one of the issues with technology still in Britain. We still need to have a situation where we're better cabled and better Wi-Fi all around the coastal regions everywhere. And there'll be more that we'll be talking about together on the coastal regions with our views with the cabinet. We're launching a Together cabinet and productivity and investment and the economy and innovation, wealth creation for everyone through development and growth is crucial. And our coastal regions are essential to that, as are our cities, urban areas, but also our marine areas, are coastal regions that are very run down in many areas, need much more investment, infrastructure, R&D, all round. We could have a future-oriented approach in Britain, which is all about creating wealth much more at a time when inflation is damaging everyone, where even though wages go up somewhat, the real wage rises have been very, very sluggish, actually since the 30s. Since the 1970s, sorry. And that's something that we need to get resolved and changed. Now, my next guest that's coming on, as I said, is a co-founder of Don't Divide Us. And she's going to be joining us shortly. And, you know, Dr. Alka Sirkle Cuthbert is an educator, academic, author and campaigner. And she really believes in the impartiality, both in education, in the context of civilized conversations in society, but also specifically for education in its own right. She's been involved in teaching as a career with English literature in inner city London for many years, and then was also on the Ofsted advisory panel on English. And she's been an ongoing teacher. She's been involved with the Civitas Education Charity, for the charity Supplementary Schools Project. She writes regularly and consistently. One of the publications is What Should Schools Teach? Disciplines, Subjects and the Pursuit of Truth for the Institute of Education. That's UCL Press. She's also spoken a number of various events and conferences around the world, and is a regular also at the Battle of Ideas. And Alka, along with others, has set this up. The report is really fascinating, and we're going to be talking to Alka in a minute. The report is Who Are the Experts by Don't Divide Us, which currently also has Dr. Tony Sewell on the board, who has had a very interesting piece in the Times that I've published actually on the Twitter piece alongside promoting this. So I am looking forward to speaking to Alka about that. And just to say, one of the things about all of these discussions about freedom of speech is that it's not so much that you would say at school everyone's got to have freedom of speech because they're children, but it is essential that us as adults in our discussion about the kind of society we want have very clear parameters about what we're doing in our schools, about what we're teaching, how we're teaching those things. Is it about, you know, education, which is about learning about history and the contemporary landscape, about, you know, maths and science and physics, and diligent quality education? Or is it much more ideological? And I think if we take a step back and look at the public sector, we've seen increasingly over the years, and this is true in the private sector as well, a much more heavily obsession and a pushing of all sorts of initiatives, ideological initiatives like ESG and EDI, equality, diversity, and inclusion, which in all sounds very good in its own terms, but when you actually start boiling down what that means, they're very particular objectives that are very ideologically laden, and it's essential that we have this discussion in public. That's something that together we're very passionate about. The public gets to be engaged and have our voices heard and not just treated with disdain and have things done to us. And many, many people in Britain and internationally, but in Britain, are very concerned about what's happening in education in a number of areas, the way our children are being taught and the things that are happening there. But what's exciting and interesting about Don't Divide Us, it seems to me, is that it's a refreshing approach about having a balanced view and a rational discussion about what Britain really is like currently. If you compare us to the rest of Europe and around the world, what it really means, you know, the wins and also some of the challenges perhaps, and what it means in terms of the conversation, particularly at school, but in institutions across the board. So I'm very pleased to welcome Dr. Alka Sirkle Cuthbert. Thanks for joining us today. I know you're super busy and well done on this report. How are you, Alka?
Thank you, Alan. Thank you for inviting me and thank you for your thanks on our report. We're very, very pleased with it and the reception that it's been receiving.
Yeah. So just before we get into the whole discussion, how did this come about, Don't Divide Us? Just tell us how that kind of emerged.
Well, it emerged in a very spontaneous way in response to an open letter in The Spectator in the autumn of 2020 after the Black Lives Matter protests. There was an online meeting in response to all the emails that were coming in reply to the open letter in The Spectator. And people were just so keen to meet up and discuss and try and work out what was going on that initially Don't Divide Us, for its sort of first 7 to 10 months, existed only as sort of online informal meetings of people who wanted to, you know, talk about these things happening, these ideas of an anti-racism that seemed very unfamiliar to people who considered themselves to be nothing but anti-racist. So they were a bit surprised when their children were coming home saying things like, you know, Mum, I think we're a really dreadful country, aren't we? Or, you know, we're really white supremacist and things like that. It didn't make sense. So from those meetings to try and make sense of things, things became a bit more formalized. I agreed to become the director of the organization and try and lead it in a more focused way around the issue of education, which primarily is because that is where our expertise and experience and most of the people who come to us through their contact with education. That's that focus. And also because education itself is such an important thing in terms of, you know, socializing, deciding the kind of values and the national narratives, the cultural ideas through which we can make a culture that is more expansive and generous and tolerant, or its opposite.
Well, so you've had a lot of press in the last week or so, and you even had Zuby and Ben Habib and Bev and all of those guys talking on GB News. It was very interesting yesterday and talking about your report. But just on this question, to kick off, there are differences between America and Britain, but are you saying, because many people would think this is not true, but are you saying that there isn't racism anymore in Britain? What's your take on that?
Okay, well, I think I would say to that is that racism is an ideological justification for discrimination and inequalities. Right. And it's not just an ideological thing. It's not just a question of ideas. It's when those ideas do have official backing, when they are, you know, hold sway in institutions, and they're used as guides to practice in the society. And I would say that that would not describe racism today. In fact, that describes anti-racism more than racism. It's anti-racism that has official backing everywhere. It's anti-racism that is being used to change the existing cultural ethos of schools. So we have to really kind of go roll right back to first principles. I think, yes, there is clearly inequality and maybe pockets of discrimination that continue, but they're not necessarily the same form that they were, you know, 20, 30, 40 years ago. And we need to look afresh, you know, since the Windrush generation, we've had waves of immigration from different places in the world, and nobody's talking about them or what's happening to them in this country. So, you know, there's a lot to be looked at afresh. And I think that old template of especially systematic and institutional racism that became very popular and widespread in the sort of 70s and 80s, I don't think does anybody any service today.
And that's very well put. So I suppose the question is, I mean, you've like this report, we can break it down. It's a number of different areas. And you know, people should know the article that the Times has done as well, that the belief that Britain is racist has taken hold at councils. It does seem everywhere, firstly, Alka, that this word racist is bandied around a lot. I mean, whether, you know, we've had it on rallies that we've done against you, Liz, that we're called the far right and that people are racist. And it just seems that it's almost being used to make it meaningless in some sense. Is that a concern as well?
Very much so. And I mean, I think Zuby put it really well on GB News yesterday in discussion with Ben Habib. You know, if you make everything racist or fascist or far right, then, you know, how do you differentiate between someone who raises a question or an objection in good faith and somebody who really does hate black people? You know, wants to get rid of them. Well, you know, you know, you can't. That, you know, if you make a phrase, if you make words that baggy, they don't really have any meaning. You know, they don't have, and it makes it much more difficult to see and identify and describe actual problems. And if we can't do that, we certainly can't start to address them. You know, and all, and you, what you get then is this sort of, the people advocating it, I think, know intuitively that intellectually the claims and ideas don't stand up to much scrutiny. They don't stand up to, you know, either empirical evidence or logical reasoning. And so the response to that intuitive sense of weakness is to become even more rigid and authoritarian, you know, and like brook no dissent, because that's what we're seeing told in schools under the EDI training is, you know, we're explicit, you know, people, teachers and children are explicitly being told the colorblind approach, that is a universalist approach based on classic Enlightenment values, tolerance, equality, freedom, that approach is no longer good. In fact, that approach is itself racist in some cases. So this is the kind of very authoritarian implications of this stuff.
When we come back from the break, we're going to talk about what EDI actually means, what CRT, all these acronyms, gets a bit confusing, but the consequences of all that. I'm Alan Miller. I'm here with Dr. Alka Zelka Cuthbert. This is TNT Radio. Join us after the break.
TNT Radio's Lynn Shaw.
The movie that is currently playing called Sound of Freedom. It is right now approaching $30 million in the box office. And the good news is most of these tickets are bought tickets because Angel Studios has put out a wonderful pay it forward program. And the program is certainly buy a ticket, but certainly we want everybody to see the movie. We just want to open this discussion up about human trafficking. That's it. That's the bottom line for this movie. Open up the discussion. Take it out from, you know, being hidden because it is dark and ugly. We can all agree on that. But let's take it out. It is happening. You know, the movie takes place in Colombia. The movie hits upon Mexico. Sure, but we have it right here in the United States. But this is a global message of what can happen. What can happen to kids? And anytime we can talk about this and provide the slightest, opening up that discussion, the slightest what we can all do as individuals, this is a good thing.
Lynn Shaw on TNT Radio.
Comedy Podcast Live, an evening of politically incorrect comedy and commentary.
If you were in the women's changing rooms and somebody came in with a penis, you used to be able to scream. Now, if you scream, they'll tell you, oh, no, that's a woman's penis. And you have to play along with it. You have to go, oh, phew, I thought there was a pervert in here. It's just a woman's penis.
I thought of something funny. I thought of like a joke that made me chuckle. I'll share that with the world. I made the catastrophic error of judgment, putting it on Twitter. That's insane.
No one plans on becoming a cougar. You just wake up one day and that shit's happened.
My mother said to me the other day, she said, darling, you're not a conspiracy theorist, are you?
Andrew Lawrence, Abby Roberts, Alistair Williams, Katie Hopkins, Newport, July 28th.
You will laugh, you will feel better, and you will realise that you're not alone. So do grab your tickets, comedypodcast.live, and I very much look forward to spending time with you there.
TNT Radio, lighting the fuse for freedom.
Weekends with Alan Miller on today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Welcome back, everyone. Alka, you were talking about EDI. Just explain to us, if you can, in a nutshell, what that is, please.
Equity, diversity, and inclusion. And it's the term used by a whole kind of new sector that has emerged in public institutions and also in private institutions as well, in businesses and the corporate world. And they have emerged. Really, what they actually do, the substance of what they do, is to, as I was saying earlier, they change the ethos of the institution in which their ideas are adopted. And they really introduce, it's almost like new ways of managing the relationships within that institution, within that organization. So it's actually very technicist and managerialist in a way, but it's combined with this super moralized, sort of turbocharged moralism of a language of equality or equity and anti-racism. So, you know, the kind of moral language, if you like, cloaks, I think, the much more technical managerialist substance of this. It certainly micromanages the way people are supposed to speak to each other informally in their work, in their workplaces or schools or nurseries even. So it's and these are businesses offering training in this. You know, when I say it's an emerging sector, these are called, you know, many of them are very wealthy companies. Some of them are transnational. Some of them are literally two women and a dog in their front room. They vary hugely. But they are all singing from the same hymn sheet in terms of how they view Britain, how they view people in Britain, and how they want to make sure everybody else adopts their worldview.
Okay, so let's talk about how this all came about, because you said it's in the private sector, it's also the public sector. We've seen in here the start of your report talks about what critical race theory is and why it shouldn't be in schools. And we talk a bit about that CRT, critical race theory. But once upon a time, not so long ago, although I'm very old, I was out involved in challenging racism when I was a young lad, and actually around Brick Lane where we developed the Truma Brewery. Before that was there. My grandparents had come from there. I remember, you know, I grew up on all those stories of Cable Street and the fights against fascism. Actually at the time, there were petrol bombs and things like that that were being put through letterboxes of Bengali families, and there were defence campaigns that were set up. I was quite inspired by some of them, kind of convincing white families locally to sort of get involved and side by side with Bengali families and stop those attacks. So, you know, anti-racism then meant something different, I think. And the world was very different. I want to say that, you know, now you're not allowed to say this, but the Britain that I grew up in and I was young in was a very, very different place, right? They didn't talk about microaggressions. And I suppose, you know, I'm sure firsthand all about all of that too, I would assume. But I suppose my question is, how did it come about? Is this the Daniel Cohn-Bendit moment where he said, you know, it's almost like the left didn't win the economic battle, the political battle, but they kind of won the cultural battle of the march through the institutions with these ideas? Because critical race theory, I mean, tell us about it. It came from the States, did it not? And some of these ideas. How did it come about that at a time where Britain's race relations so vastly transformed from where they once were, say four decades ago, that this is now the situation? What has that come about from your point of view, Alka?
Well, I think you've mentioned one important strand, the kind of developments within academia, which have been going on for decades. But I think it's also quite important to understand that, you know, they have been going on for decades without us being in the situation we find ourselves in now. So clearly there's other things happening that have enabled what are essentially a kind of arcane set of speculative theories within academia, where, by the way, they can have a useful place as long as they're understood as theories, you know, one theory amongst other competing theories to be discussed and scrutinized. But once they expand out of those tight limits into society at large, and once they expand beyond just questions of theoretical knowledge, but instead become rules of practice, and actually change the way people behave and the way they speak, then the way they think, even come to that, it is a kind of attempt to shape our consciousnesses in a way. I know that can sound a wee bit conspiratorial, but the whole kind of psychologization, if you like, of social questions is another thing I think that is feeding into this. Whereas you say, you know, when I was involved in anti-racism, we were not going around looking at whether people were raising eyebrows at each other in a funny way. We were concerned with whether or not people were being actively discriminated against through, access to social public goods that everybody else had, political rights, or just through, being cruelly and violently treated in social life. So there were very empirical, concrete problems that we were facing on that we were facing and trying to address, and trying to address not through emphasizing our separateness or making appeals for people to be kind or nice to us because we were so special. I'm saying we here as a person of color, by the way. You can't see that on radio, can you? We were doing it by saying, you know, we believe in equality. We believe in these things that have inspired everyone from Frederick Douglass to Jawaharlal Nehru to fight for freedom. And, you know, we want to find our way of making these values more real for more people now. That is the absolute polar opposite of what today's anti-racism is about. It is absolutely not about endorsing the idea that people who may be suffering discrimination can fight alongside non-white, you know, white people in order to join the majority in taking society as a whole forward. It's much more about special pleading or cynical, you know, cynical kind of entitlement grabs, and shutting other people down and actually delegitimizing the very values that have helped us get to where we are today, which is a much better place than we were 50, 60 years ago.
So, I mean, what are your findings in this report? Just if you can annotate and summarize this latest report.
Yeah. Okay, so one of the reasons we did this report is that since our first report last year and the subsequent media coverage of trans ideology and third party providers in schools, you know, it's very frustrating when people say, well, you know, this isn't really happening. It's only happening in a few schools. Where are the numbers? How many schools is this happening in? As if everything was a case of numbers, you know, and it isn't. In social life, it really isn't the case of that the numbers always are the all-determining thing. There are hierarchies and there's status. So if somebody from the Church of England endorses critical race theory, it carries a different weight and significance in society than if, you know, Fred Bloggs down the road were to, right? So it's like understanding. So we wanted to look at as big a sample as we could of these organisations, and just take a look at the provide a more granular picture. Look at their provenance. Who are the people that where do they get their money from, and what are their ideas that they their central mission, if you like, that they themselves, you know, it's not kind of interpreting. We're taking them at their own words. We're looking at their own publicity on their own websites, and finding that these 48 out of the 49 in our sample all endorse the idea that Britain is institutionally racist. A lot of them make reference to Britain's role in the historical role in the past with slavery and colonialism. Only one actually mentions the fact that Britain was the first country to abolish slavery, which I think is pretty shocking. And they are actively encouraging. They're not just providing the odd lesson or assembly content. They provide training for teachers. They provide reading lists. They provide directories of staff that schools can, you know, look up if they want somebody to come in and do their EDI. And of course, like I said before, they are all singing from the same hymn sheet. They don't invite writers or thinkers who would promote a different view to a socially justice, if you like, inflected view on questions of race. So in this way, the most astonishing thing is the question of democratic accountability, because the DfE either doesn't know, or it knows a bit and doesn't want to know more, or it knows and is just ignoring it. So there's no accountability to the DfE. Ofsted will not act unless it gets a green light from the DfE. That isn't happening. It's very hard for parents or ordinary citizens to find out about these organisations. Schools are quite wary. Not only are they quite wary, but oftentimes they may well not know. Because what happens at school level is that, you know, something happens in the press one week, it's all over the news. The head goes in and think, you know, if they've got particular parents who are particularly into this and demanding something be done, they'll just kind of go for the do a quick Google thing and grab the nearest EDI organization they can find, thinking that they will handle it better than they themselves can. And it, you know, once they get in, once they're there in schools, it becomes very difficult to either remove them. I mean, not all of them are there for long-term contracts. Some of them might only be there for a short time. But each time a school hires them, they're giving a bit more endorsement to that way of seeing the world. So, you know, that this is kind of what is happening. It's not just a case of numbers. No, there is nobody offering an alternative, not the exam boards, not the professional associations, not the local educational authorities, or the teaching unions. You know, they are all either actively promoting it, or they are embarrassedly or tacitly just remaining silent.
So you have a lot of people that are very well known, people like Catherine Birbalsingh and others that are connected to some of the work you're doing, that are teachers that have made a mark. I'm, you know, on your website and in your publications, you talk about colorblind anti-racism, that based on individuals worthy of respect, regardless of, you know, race or religion, and what Martin Luther King used to talk about, the character of someone, not their pigmentation. Now, I spent a lot of time in the States, and some of the discussions there have become so shrill and very difficult, particularly the racial discussions. It's almost impossible to have them. People get very scared and nervous about it. They get shut down very quickly. People are accused of all sorts of things. And you guys talk about it, this white privilege question, that you have to admit it. It's like the denial thing. You have to say it. You have to admit it. That you're suffering from it, and if you don't recognize it, then everything's illegitimate about what you're saying, and it doesn't really allow for a proper discussion or to convince people of things, right? And in a way, it seems like that has percolated a lot here. But from the work that you've been doing, and you mentioned some of the trans questions in terms of institutions and schools, it does seem that in the last year and a half or so, last couple of years, but there's been a lot of the public getting involved in this discussion and hearing more about it through initiatives such as yours and others, means that there's a pushback around a lot of this stuff. How do you respond to that? Do you think that's true? Do you think, you know, it's having an impact in changing things? What's your thoughts on it?
Well, put it this way, I don't think we'd have got the coverage we've got this week 2.5 years ago, right? It's although, you know, we were saying more or less the same thing. I mean, we have got more experience, more examples, and, you know, the report itself is a report rather than an op-ed. It's based on empirical, it has an empirical basis. But yes, I think you're right. People are, you know, people are sense that there's something really smelling rotten in the state of Denmark. And oftentimes it kind of fixates on one particular issue that's of interest to them. So it could be, you know, the things you've been involved with around transport, or it could be, you know, what education or other things. But what we, and it's really good that people are beginning to push back, you know, they are beginning to ask questions. I mean, in education, I think it's particularly tricky because of all the, you know, as a parent, you experience things in a very individuated way. It's different to being a member of a workforce. You kind of, there isn't, and it's not like America where you have parent boards and, you know, education boards across a region. It is much more fragmented here, but still, you know, just from our inbox, people are beginning to question. We have so many people wanting to know how they can raise it with their schools. Thankfully, it's not as shrill as it is in America, and I really hope it doesn't get to that state here, because that's very, very, unpleasant to say the least. And Britain does have a different history. You know, it does have a different experience in terms of race relations. So I think these kind of all these the different groups that are kind of popping up now, wanting to challenge this emerging narrative that people feel, rightly feel, is being imposed upon them, because it is. Nobody has voted for this, and most of the time, very few people have been involved in any discussion about these measures. So that has to be done. But I think, you know, in addition to reacting against things, we really need to move forward. We need to think about constructive alternatives as well. You know, I think with every deconstructive argument, you've got to kind of think of, well, what would you, you know, it's like I say to people who come to us, if you got rid of all the EDI organisations tomorrow in Britain, in schools, it still wouldn't mean we have a good education system, because clearly there was something really wrong happening in schools, or else the EDI organisations would not have been able to get such a foothold. You know, they would not be so influential if things were not already quite dramatically wrong in Britain, in Britain's schools. And I think that was a lot to do with decades of, you know, a kind of very technicist, managerialist approach, and changing the nature of educate schools.
So on the technocrats, and managerial controls, we're going to come back to that after this break. I'm Alan Miller. This is TNT Radio. Come back straight after the break.
De-weaponizing weather with reality and perspective.
The times, they certainly are a-changing. In fact, here are some important climate terms due to the agenda-driven climate policy that we're seeing today. One, Marxist meteorological misinformation media. Purpose, blow up every event and link it to global catastrophe in an effort to change the social order. Two, Hunter Biden laptop methodology. Simply ignore counter evidence, cover it up all you can. Three, weaponization of weather. Utilize this with each event. That can just tie into the Marxist meteorological misinformation media, since that's what they do. Finally, to bundle it all up, deception, distortion, and delusion. And like I said, it sort of encompasses all of the above. So this is what we're faced with. And just remember, the guy that's leading this, the climate czar of the United States, showed up at a conference with all these medals on his chest. Likely well-earned. I'm not saying they're not well-earned. But gee whiz, didn't he tell us he threw those things away? Wonder what else he's lying about. This is TNT climate and weather watchdog meteorologist Joe Bastardi asking you to enjoy the weather. It's the only weather you got.
You took the first step and quit smoking, but even former smokers may still be at risk for lung cancer. That's why SaveByTheScan.org wants you to know about a new low-dose CT scan that can detect lung cancer early. It takes only 60 seconds and could save your life. You took the first step, now take the next. Visit SaveByTheScan.org for a simple quiz to see if you're eligible and talk to your doctor about screening. SaveByTheScan.org is brought to you by the American Lung Association's Lung Force Initiative and the Ad Council.
Alan Miller on today's News Talk, TNT Radio.
Welcome back, everyone. I'm here with Dr. Alka Selgut Cuthbert. And in this report, Don't Divide Us, of which Alka is the co-founder, who are the experts? It talks about these third-party groups that operate in ways that avoid public accountability, political responsibility, and have very little basis in established academic or educational sources of authority. And the report goes on to say, any government that takes democracy, freedom of speech, and tolerance seriously also needs to take education seriously. Well, I might argue that in the last few years, this government has not taken those things seriously, even though they've implemented some new laws that allege that they do, whilst at the same time new laws that clamp down on things. I think they're incoherent and erratic. But that shouldn't be a reason why these things should not be happening. I think it's very, very important that you raise this. But you've got a lovely diagram in your report about these third-party groups and organisations. You know, just for parents particularly, but for all of us as well, what would you like to see happen? I mean, you've mentioned even if we got rid of some of the EDI, there'd still be a problem in terms of diligence and qualitative education. How, you know, talk to us about your recommendations, what you would like to see happen in the immediacy and then a bit more longer term.
Yeah. I'll talk a bit in our recommendations. We talk about two types. One short term, if you like, to address the immediate problem. One short term recommendation is that the government or the DfE, the government, makes issues a mandatory instruction that schools have to teach impartially, right? It is really, really important. That is the key of a broadly liberal education in a democratic society. The standards of impartiality have to be affirmed and adhered to. Then they should make that a criteria in Ofsted inspections. You know, Ofsted inspections inspect, you know, loads of things, often things that are far from central in education, but this is crucial. So it should be made, sadly, it needs to be, you know, something that is inspected. Now, that's a short-term thing. That won't solve the problem itself. I think on the longer term, I think we need to look back and see what we can find in the institutional history of Britain's education system to see if we might gain, you know, get some ideas and, hints from what's happened in the past. Now, the period when Britain was developing its school system on a mass scale between 1944 and, say, the early 70s, in a kind of broadly social democratic manner, was a period where education was shaped by a body called the Central Advisory Committee for Education, or CASE. This itself, you know, this isn't like a silver bullet, but this was a permanent standing body, which meant that education didn't become, or was less able to become, a political football amongst the different parties, because it was cross-party, it was permanent, it was advisory, and its role was to look around, read, think, discuss with a broad range of people to advise on government policy to do with schooling and education more broadly. And since that has kind of ended, I think it's really opened the way to education and now even the curriculum itself to become a kind of weapon of choice of every government to dump any problem that belongs to other spheres of social policy that they don't want to deal with. They just dump it onto teachers to deal with. And this is ridiculous. You know, you cannot have educate children if you have, you know, if schools and teachers are thinking they've got to address the economy, they've got to address children's fatness or thinness, and now they have to address children's racism and transgenderism. You know, this is just a nonsense. It makes nonsense of the very idea of education.
When I for a short period of time, I was on the London Arts Council and the London Arts Board, and there was a similar thing that was happening, that there were so many instrumentalist policies. You had all these tick boxes that artists had to do about social exclusion, obesity, you know, a range of areas that you think, well, can't we just do the best art that we can do? And it was quite cynical. And it sounds like what you're saying in the education in a similar way. I suppose the whole question of what education, it's entirely political, but there's a moral base as well about the kind of society we're in, which some people would argue, well, there are issues like diet that have always been part of the consideration, like the introduction of school meals or milk for people at a certain age and all of that type of thing. Is that not really, I mean, I know there's been raging debates. They used to call Margaret Thatcher the milk snatcher. Some people did. And then we've had Jamie Oliver and the whole thing about food. But food is a big part of it, as it always has been, hasn't it? Some would, you know, is that not something, or should it just be about history and arithmetic, and how do you see that?
It's quite funny, actually. I was just watching last night, they're bringing back dental inspections into schools in some areas. I mean, we used to have that when I was an infant school. I'm not against a reasonable level of things that are not to do with the curriculum being in schools. Schools do have a broader duty of care. But the crucial thing is all the things that you mentioned and I've mentioned coexisted alongside, if you like, a tacit understanding and agreement that the main job of schools was to introduce the younger generation into a body, you know, sort of school subjects that were derived from the best knowledge we have. And the best formal knowledge we have is kind of academic, disciplinary knowledge, which not everybody is involved in, right? That is not, you know, disciplinary knowledge is not a democratic thing. It is, if you like, an intellectually elitist thing. It's what has been produced in academia. And then in society, that, you know, if we value that, then that is associated with a valuation of truth and truthfulness. So if we value that, we then allow different people, you know, the exam boards, the teaching professions, to work on recontextualizing that best knowledge so that it becomes understandable to school children. And that's what the school curriculum should be. You know, it should be knowledge that is derived from the best knowledge that we have collectively as a society. And so it means that was always, it was never explicitly spelt out in Britain. But I think now we need to spell it out because it's under such threat. Because now it is the curriculum itself, it is knowledge itself that is being dismissed in a very cavalier, unjustified way as being racist and harmful, you know, unless you happen to be, you know, a white middle-aged male, which is patently not true. So that's why questions of curriculum and knowledge, even though they might seem, oh, you know, goodness, what's this got to do with five-year-olds? Okay, this might be all right for academics in, you know, university students. But actually, it's crucial. It's crucial for everyone in education, from five-year-olds to, you know, 22-year-old graduates.
Yeah. So when Matthew Arnold wrote when he wrote in his book Culture and Anarchy that we should be teaching the best that was ever thought and known and written, I'm paraphrasing it badly, but that's been contested and part of the culture wars for a long time. But there does seem to be this embarrassment more broadly, culturally and politically, with our achievements. And it seems like there's the kind of reproduction of only some terrible things. There's a lot to talk about. We haven't got that long left. I want to talk, you did a very lovely example of when Frederick Douglass Jr. came to Rochdale. But just, I want to ask you this question. We'll come back to him if we've got time. But just, there are a lot of now white working class boys in particular that are disproportionately doing badly in education. And if we look back, I mean, the original racial ideas, the geneticist ones and all that, they were based on eugenics. They were based on ideas of, well, they were really class-based in many ways, but based on all sorts of weird ideas, but that became kind of quite accepted. And they were very much about in the idea of very specific things, not colour particularly, but very much determined by class, and were promoted significantly. I wonder how much, because now we're seeing in America as well, a resegregation in university campuses of either black only or white only halls and things like that, things that many people fought many years to overcome and get rid of, as seen as a kind of, that's seen as a kind of good thing in some quarters that that's happening. And I wonder how much you think it's these ideas that are allowing that to happen with, like, for instance, young white working class boys, what are the reasons why it would be that they're not doing as well? And also in that context, is the solution still just give them the best education they can? Or is it a broader question about what we could do politically and in the economy and other things? What's your take on it? I know it's a difficult question, but just interested to hear what you think.
Okay, well, I mean, the freedom for schools to teach a really good liberal curriculum to all children has to be secured politically. There's no doubt about that. The argument has to be made. There is still, sadly, too many parents, for example, who will say, well, I don't really care what they do at school as long as my kid's happy. You know, that might have flown, you know, 10, 20 years ago, but I'm afraid I really don't think we've got that luxury anymore. I think parents need to be much more alert to what is happening, what is being taught to their children in schools. So there has to be a wider political argument, if you like, and it will be an argument because there are vested interests in this. But it is a case of, do we want, the question has to be put to the people, do we want schools to be producing activists, which is a social justice version of education? Or do we want schools to be producing individual citizens who have had the chance to develop their intellectual and imaginative faculties so they can look around as adults and decide which causes they wish to support or whether they want to be an activist or not when they are developmentally and politically and every other way old enough to do so on their own independently without the influence of other adults? And that's the kind of, if you like, the key distinction. And I think that is not one that can be won or had within education itself. It would be a broader social and political question for sure. Then on to your point about the white working class boys, I don't think that they have been, you know, that their underachievement is due particularly to social justice alone. I think this is a kind of, this ideology certainly isn't helping. But I mean, they've been doing badly for a long time in schools, actually, in Britain. And there are lots of different reasons fueling into this. Just briefly, I would say the reasons internal to education goes back to the managerialism, the high stakes, constant monitoring and examination that really squashes the freedom for teachers to experiment and try different ways of teaching. Now, different ways of teaching doesn't mean total relativism. It doesn't mean you teach what you like. You still have to choose the best content for schools. But there are different ways of teaching Romeo and Juliet, for example. You can adjust the pace, for example, or the sequencing of what you're teaching. These are all things that teachers should be, this is what teacher education should be about, learning how to do this, not learning which books to push to make kids a better ally, you know, or the latest Ibram Kendi book. That is not what teachers in Britain need to know about. They need to know about epistemology, the history of education, the philosophy of education. So in other words, I think the problems that face any pupils, whether they're white working class or black Afro-Caribbean, won't be, I think, addressed by looking at it just from that their particular perspective of ethnicity. They and all other pupils will all be better served when schools have that freedom and are re-intellectualized and re-moralized around their, if you like, their intrinsic purpose, which is to teach, you know, the best knowledge, the most truthful knowledge that we have, impartially.
So I came to the launch of your report, and you were and it was saying we've only got a tiny amount of time left, but you did a very beautiful example when Frederick Douglass came to Rochdale, and he said, "I came as a slave and left as a free man because of the Quakers," and just making an example of not how everything in Britain has not always been all one-sided. The Royal Navy did do the shipping lanes to prevent slavery. Where can people find you? Very quickly, Alka, give us your tags
Please go to don'tdivideus.com. You can read both our reports there, and I have got an ongoing petition that we want to submit in autumn. Please do sign that. We need as many signatures as we can, calling for schools to educate and not indoctrinate. And you'll find a lot of other stuff there as well.
Brilliant, Alka. We'd love to have you back again soon. Keep up the good work. Excellent stuff. Thank you. I'm Alan Miller. This is TNT Radio. We'll see you after the news.